Thank you, Guy. Thank you, everybody. One of the things I always find most interesting and most inspiring about these gatherings, as Guy says, I've been coming to these for 5 years now, is that it's not just a room of incredible writers that you spend time with, that so many of you are actually such great performers as well. I say it's interesting and inspiring, it's actually quite irritating in many ways, because I'm very much a writer first and a performer last. I love living in the shadows that René described. So I make no apologies for reading my main presentation from a prepared script. But I will tell you my favourite story about the difference between those two elements. Was when I was working for the Labour Party, there was a huge occasion celebrating the life of Nye Bevan. If you don't know who Nye Bevan is, he's a huge totemic figure in the Labour Party, very much credited with the creation of the NHS, the National Health Service in the UK, and he's probably the most oft-quoted Labour politician in the UK. And there was a huge event commemorating his legacy and the creation of the NHS up in Ebbervale, near his hometown. And all the great and the good of the Labour Party were there, and they were there to celebrate Nye Bevan, so they were trying to outdo each other with the speeches. They really went for the rhetoric hard, really flowing prose, and one MP after another, really trying to outdo them. But they all had this one problem: the last speaker was somebody called Michael Sheen. Now, probably a lot of you have heard of Michael Sheen. He's a great Hollywood actor, happens to be Welsh. And he did something that none of them did, and they all wish that they probably had thought about. And he didn't give an off-the-speech flowing, an off-the-cuff flowing speech. He actually brought along an old speech of Nye Bevan's, and he read it. And he read it like Michael Sheen would read it. And absolutely blew the socks off the audience, absolutely blew the socks off all the media that were there. All they wanted to do was show Michael Sheen's reading that afternoon. And that's also all the journalists wanted to talk to the MPs about afterwards. And one MP with a rather large ego was asked for the umpteenth time, "What did you think of Michael Sheen? What did you think? What did you feel?" And he said, "I thought he read really nicely." And so I can't promise to give you a Michael Sheen style performance, but I will do my best to read nicely, at the very least, with my prepared script. So I've started with an apology. Let me follow that up with a confession. I have 29,534 unread emails in my inbox. I know, that brings some people out in hives. I'm sorry. By way of contrast, I've only got one email in my drafts folder, and it's been there since the 11th of November, 2021. And it's to someone who's a great friend of this conference and whom I was lucky enough to meet and hear speak. His name is Edward Mortimer. He was a speechwriter to the former UN Secretary General Kofi Annan, and he was one of the first speakers that I saw at one of these events. And he had, I don't know if any of you know him or remember him, but he had this kind of languid, easy intellect that could have charmed an audience of any size on any topic. He was inspirational. My rather hurried email, which I never got round to sending, was seeking advice before an interview to try and follow in his footsteps, sort of. I'd secured an interview, much to my surprise, with the United Nations to join the Secretary General's speechwriting team. Sadly for me, I didn't get that job, but happily the experience did open a few doors with the UN. And it opened my eyes to a whole new world of communications challenges, which I want to discuss with you today. And the central question I want to explore is how we can reach and move global audiences when constrained by three key considerations. Actually, there's loads more than three. But attending these conferences year after year has persuaded me that the human brain, which is capable of solving quadratic equations, writing concertos that can lift the soul, minds that conceive the wonders of space, time, science, love, hate, and poetry, we can only actually count to three. So here goes. First, you are constrained by language. You'll often be writing for a speaker who may have English as their second, third, fourth, even fifth language. And no matter how fluent or brilliant a speaker they may be, that often results in an understandable nervousness towards wider expression. And this is, of course, amplified by the nature of your audience. At the UN, or even in a room like this, at any big international conference, you could be writing for a room full of people representing over 100 countries with different cultures, languages, and dialects. And that's before you get into other motivations and identities of politics, gender, age, and religion. And as one of the things that we speech writers often tell our colleagues is you always need to consider the needs of your audience first. This is a really daunting task. And often, this compels us towards a soft middle ground of generalities and platitudes. We leave rhetorical devices at the door, and we inadvertently turn our speakers into walking, talking briefing notes. I assume that this is the real reason why so many speeches on the international stage ignore the sage advice we were given last year by Terry Zuplat. He told us never to begin a speech with acknowledgements, and yet speakers so often do. And they begin not just by acknowledging most of the people in the room, but also what the room is, and where the room is, and why we're all in the room together. Sometimes there are reflections on the shape of the room, and even how to get out of that room in an emergency. And you get through all of that, and you're halfway through your word count, and you haven't said a damn thing. For the record, I agree with Terry. Secondly, you are clearly constrained by the frequent, and again, very understandable need to maintain friendly and diplomatic relations with the widest possible audience. As another former speaker here, Mike Long, once reminded us, you don't win many arguments by starting, "Hey, stupid." And yet, in our fear of showing disrespect or cultural insensitivity, this, again, can move us as writers towards a safety-first approach, staying away from the stories and the specifics that we know would light up a room, tidying away the utopian fervour in favour of utilitarian frumpiness. The third constraint, quite simply, is pace and volume, often. Frequently, you'll be asked to help on something so last minute that the best you can do is damage limitation. You can find a phrase or two with some stickability and hope for the best. When I'm asked to write a keynote speech for a CEO, it's not uncommon to be given months of prep with as much face time as you need. In fast-paced international organisations, you could be writing or at least editing three or more statements in a day. Not a paranoid man, generally, but there are times when I feel that drafts might have been held back until the last second, safe in the knowledge that I would only have a certain amount of time to play with a precious policy official's well-crafted statements. But again, those time constraints move you towards safe options. I don't have time to turn that statistic into a story. I don't have time to cut that plan from 20 points to 3. I don't have time to check that that singer I want to quote from isn't actually a political prisoner in that country, for example. So let me be clear, all these constraints, language, political, time, they're absolutely valid. And consider what happens when you ignore them, as Boris Johnson did when giving a climate speech to the UN General Assembly. He decided to quote from Kermit the Frog and questioned his relationship to Miss Piggy. Or you can try to heal all the world's problems by declaring, as did the FIFA president on the eve of the Qatar World Cup, saying, "Today I have very strong feelings. Today I feel Qatari. Today I feel Arab. Today I feel African. Today I feel gay. Today I feel disabled. Today I feel a migrant worker." He went on to claim he understood what it meant to be discriminated against because he was picked on for having freckles at school. So you can do that. You can do that. That would make you stand out, but perhaps not in the way you would like. Let me clearly state the privileged position from which I write. I've never known extreme poverty. I've never had to hand my daughter to a stranger in the night and pray for her safety. I've never had to flee my home because of conflict or climate change. But I am passionate about those stories being heard, those stories being remembered, and crucially, those stories being acted upon. And my big concern is that people sort of dismiss the boring statement in these sorts of forums. It isn't great, but it's the price of doing business. It's a problem that people don't really listen, but does that really stop the world spinning on its axis? Well, yes, it very well might. The problem isn't the fact that we're just being boring, that we're not just being heard. The real problem is that when people stop listening, it becomes fundamentally dangerous and undemocratic. We risk creating censorship through caution. When people stop listening, stop paying attention, stop connecting, we create a vacuum. And if recent history is anything to go by, a vacuum powered by cowardice or tedium tends to get filled with political napalm. And so we must strive to do better, to be a little braver. Now, you may be forgiven that as a more or less monoglot, with all these privileges I just listed, I'm not best placed to be thinking about the notion of a culture clash and how this could be best avoided. It's a fair challenge. But I do bring one secret weapon to the arena, and that is my Welshness. For those of you not familiar with the historic and geographical makeup of the UK, Wales is England's slightly less rebellious neighbour. We have our own parliament, our own government, our own laws, our own language, Britain's oldest language, in fact, a culture that is unique and distinct, not just from England, but also from our Celtic cousins. We're just not quite as noisy as the Scots and Northern Irish. But as befits a smaller and superior neighbour, we have a fine nose for what it is to be offended. Indeed, we Welsh are famously thin-skinned as a nation. We have so many chips on our shoulders, we're a mere bavette steak from being a good dinner. And although there is evidence aplenty from the centuries of genuine repression and rebellion, that is not so much the case today. Often there is more humour than hate or hubris to be found in lapses of communication or cultural breakdowns. In fact, we can often be our own worst enemies. Take, for example, our frequent inability to adequately translate from English to Welsh. It is by law a requirement to have bilingual signage, for example. There was a recent commendable attempt by Tesco to adopt the more Welsh language in their stores in Wales. This extended to services outside the shop, including the cash machine. Now, first of all, I should say I have huge reservations about the English used on those cash machines. Free cash withdrawals? It's not how my bank manager sees it. Anyway, terrible misleading English or not, it was translated into Welsh. Codiad am ddim. There's just one problem. Codiad am ddim doesn't mean free withdrawals, it means free erections. And it brings Tesco's motto, every little helps, into fresh perspective. Perhaps my favourite story of this nature happened a few years before. A sign went up for pedestrians in Cardiff for a new one-way street. In English, it advised them to look right. In Welsh, to look left. I like to think that there's something deeply philosophical about that. Either that or somebody who's just trying to get the English speakers run over. But occasionally, there is merit in our complaints as a nation. The ruling Conservative Party in Westminster have a mixed and troubled history connecting with Welsh voters. Every administration has been Labour-led since devolution became a fact of life in 1999. And often the Tories don't help themselves. One classic example was their decision to appoint John Redwood as Welsh Secretary in 1993. His constituency was not in Wales, but Wokingham, an English market town some 40 miles from London. His arch Thatcherite views, so out of tune with Welsh political feeling at the time, made him a pantomime villain, even before his ultimate fall from grace. At a Welsh Conservative Party conference, he was asked to participate in the singing of the Welsh National Anthem in the Welsh language at the close. And I'm hoping that Guy might be able to show us what followed.
Let's see what happens.
Let's see what happens. Otherwise, we'll have to act it out.
Oh.
It's looking promising.
Considering that I'm a classicist, this is super impressive.
Still makes me cringe, no matter how many times. Yeah.
Don't know what's happened.
There we go.
Okay.
So that's over 30 years ago, and that's still deeply embedded in Welsh culture and Welsh psyche. And wherever John Redwood goes, that follows him around, just that one clip. It is actually the very definition, the literal definition of what it is to pay lip service to a culture. And so, whilst I'm at times overwhelmed by the nature of communicating to so many different audiences at once, I hope my education as a chippy Welshman has at least honed some aspects of cultural sensitivity. But what is to be done? I said earlier that each constraint that holds back the writer and the speaker during international dialogue is perfectly valid, and it is. But how do we loosen the cords sufficiently to be heard and to lead? In our attempts, in the slightly altered words of David Murray, in our effort to be understood. I'm going to take my lead as some words of advice from Chris Voss, the former FBI negotiator. He said, the language of negotiation is primarily of conversation and rapport, a way of quickly establishing relationships and getting people to talk and think together. That is a simple and effective way of thinking about all communication, in my view, and speeches, certainly. Even when we are just writing to inform, not to inspire, we can still seek to build a rapport with our readers and listeners and to get people thinking and talking together. That word, together. I find the quickest route to that rapport is rediscovering our sense of humanity. Rather than focusing so hard on what we might not have in common, language, culture, experience, to think about what we do and where differences exist, acknowledge it respectfully. Jackie Robinson, the first black person to play Major League Baseball and a civil rights campaigner, put it beautifully when he said, I believe in the human race. I believe in the warm heart. I believe in a warm heart too. I believe all speechwriters should. What does that mean in a practical sense? I think about the speech made by Malala on receiving her Nobel Peace Prize. She joked that she was probably the only recipient of that award that still fought with her younger brothers. It was a gentle joke, but it had universal reach. No matter the shape of our own family, scrapping between siblings is something we can all understand. I think about one of the first speeches I helped draft at the UN, covering the history of some long sought after and complex change in the measurement of vulnerability. We didn't just plot the history of the campaign and how the numbers had changed over time. We asked the audience to think carefully about where they were and what they were doing 30 years ago when that campaign started. This truly underlined the passage of time in a more human way. It made the connection to the issue personal to them and not just theoretical. And when we celebrated the new incoming chair to a position of authority, we took trouble to find a line of poetry, not just from their home nation in their home language, but from their favourite poet with which to honour them. A little human touch, a warm heart. When I started working with the UN, I asked my appointing director for a last word of advice on my initial conversation with her for a complete novice on that sort of stage. And she said, we need you to save us from ourselves. Be bold, be bold. I was astounded. Just that day, my closest friend had sent me an old commencement speech by Susan Sontag to wish me luck. Its closing message, be bold, be bold, be bold. Those very words, twice on the same day. But a word of caution. Taken from the old English fairy tale of Mr. Fox, the full line actually goes like this. Be bold, but not too bold. Lest that your heart's blood should run cold. And that's our challenge, that's our tightrope, but it is a formula I hope and believe that Edward Mortimer would accept for us. Two parts bold, one part not too bold. That gives us enough room, I hope, to be understood, to connect, and to be remembered. Thank you.